and kids K through second, you can start making your way to the story time. And kids not, you'll want to make sure you grab one of the kids' bulletins so you can track along. And adults, if you also noticed in your bulletin, I'll tell you a little bit more about this, but in yours is notes for personal study and community group, so it's a little more full outline from the sermon today to help you to internalize and work some of the things you'll hear this morning into your own heart, or also a resource and tool for community groups with questions to help further the discussion about what you'll hear this morning. And my goal this morning is to reorient you to the book of Exodus. So we started in September going through the book of Exodus, and our big theme is kind of three words: deliver. We're delivered to dwell. So God delivers his people, he directs them through the wilderness, and then the whole point is so that he can dwell with them. And at the turn of this year, starting in January, we did a deep dive into the Ten Commandments found in Exodus 20, and now we're pulling back out and going to get moving back through the book, and the goal is to finish Exodus by the end of May. So I want to reorient you and just kind of focus to what our key themes will be and what the broad movement of Exodus is. And for the next 2 months, so for this month and then through May, our larger theme is going to be this idea that we live in a world that is where people claim to be spiritual but not religious. So that comes from, there was a book that was titled that and came out in 2000, and it kind of gave us this nomenclature where we live in a world where people are recognizing that there has to be something more than just this material world. And so people are open and hungry for some type of transcendence. They're seeking some type of connection with, whether it's like higher energy or the spark of divinity within, but they're very clear that we're not religious. So 22% of people polled by Pew Research study found 22% of Americans would take on that designation: I'm spiritual but not religious. And not being religious means that, you know, I reject the institutional forms that religion has taken. It's very internal and personalized. So the question we're going to ask is, all right, people want to encounter the living God, but how do you do that? Is it possible to be spiritual and not religious? And one of the fundamental points we're going to make this whole time is that, according to the Bible, what real spirituality is, so that's our thing, what is real spirituality? Real spirituality is not ultimately us reaching out towards God or looking within, but it's responding to the living God who has done something first. He has come down, he has spoken, he has acted, and we respond to who he is and what he has done. So if you want to see him, if you want to encounter him for who he truly is, you have to begin with what he has said and what he has done. And it's as you see that it begins to rework the motivational drives of your heart. You become truly transformed. You can have a life-changing encounter with the living God, but there's certain things you're going to need in place if you're going to do that. So that's our big theme. How can you have a regular, life-changing encounter with the living God, a living relationship with the God of the universe? So that's the key theme of Exodus. And you know, there's so much more to the story of Exodus that often gets portrayed in the movies. So, for example, if you saw The Prince of Egypt, you know, the movie ends when they cross the Red Sea. But that only gets you to about chapter 15 of the book. And it goes all the way to chapter 40. And so we're moving into a section that can be hard for us because it doesn't have all of the high drama of a movie, all of the drama. In some ways, we get like building codes, and then you get different commands. And so it can, when you're reading through it, it can bog down. But my goal for the next 2 months is just show you how much beauty and power and life is really here. So there's a lot more to the story. So we're at Exodus. We've come to chapter 19. Now in chapter 19 in Exodus, they come to the foot of Mount Sinai. Now, they're going to stay at the foot of Mount Sinai all the way from Exodus 19 to Numbers 10. So we're about to spend a long time, if you go through Exodus all the way through Deuteronomy, a long time is here at Sinai. Well, a little over a year, but a lot of the book is there. And let's actually flip over. So if you have your Bibles, you can flip or you can just listen. Let's go to the end of the story. It's not a bad idea. There's two types of readers of fiction. People who read the last page first, and then people who despise people who read the last page first. Now, when you're reading through the Bible, it's not a bad idea. It's okay to start at the last page so it can help make sense of what's happening. So you can look at Exodus chapter 40, and here's verse 34. They've just built the tabernacle. They've consecrated it. They've dedicated it. And it says, the cloud covered the tent of meeting. That's what it is, a tent of meeting. It's where you can go to meet the living God. And he's promised to dwell with them. And the glory of the Lord filled their tabernacle. And Moses was unable to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud rested on it. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And the Israelites set out with whatever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle throughout all the stages of their journey. If the cloud was not taken up, they did not set out until the day was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day. And there was fire inside the cloud by night, visible to the entire house of Israel throughout all the stages of their journey. So they build the tabernacle, the glory descends, and now God's presence is back among its people. In many ways, this is the drama that began in Genesis chapter 3, once Adam and Eve sinned and they were cast out of the garden, that place of God's close dwelling where heaven and earth touched down, and now God can dwell once again. He's made a way so his people can come back into his presence. So the whole point is, all right, how do we live and dwell in the presence of the Lord? How can we encounter him? And so where we are in this stage is we're in chapter 19. They come to Mount Sinai, and this section from 19 to 24, in essence, is called the Book of the Covenant. Because this is where God has called his people, and now he's going to make a covenant with them. And this is going to be a really important concept that we have to kind of continually think through over the next couple weeks. This idea of covenant, because we don't live in a culture that really understands or values these types of relationships. So we live in a consumer world where nearly all of the relationships we have are consumeristic. They're driven by the market. You meet my needs in the way that I desire on my terms, and then we can be in relationship. But as soon as I stop finding value in that relationship or the dynamic, I'm out. Those are part of the market-driven dynamics. And what that has filtered into kind of every relationship we have. And you know, it's one thing to kind of treat like where you buy your organic milk from in those categories. But if you start treating like your neighbor that way, or you start treating your wife that way, or you start treating your child that way, things really break down. So there's just certain relationships that a consumeristic mentality will just ruin. And the church, God's people, is meant to be one of those covenantal relationships. So we're going to have to do some work to get in the mindset of, all right, what does that actually mean? Because in many ways, marriage is kind of the last, like, covenantal relationship that we have. And that's actually a good image for understanding this section of Exodus. One of the things God will use all throughout Exodus and all throughout the Bible, God will take physical things to point you to spiritual realities. So part of the high drama of Exodus 1 through 18 is because God uses the imagery of Israel is my firstborn son. And Pharaoh has taken my firstborn son hostage. And you either let him go or I'm going to come get him back. And so if you want to, like, the first part of Exodus is almost like the movie Taken, where God is going to get his encaptured child back. But now in Exodus 20, it shifts, and now the metaphor is not only is God Israel's father, but there's also this marital dynamic. He's Israel's husband, and so he's going to use that as a metaphor to show this is what the relationship is like. And in many ways, Moses is kind of the officiant he's officiating the wedding ceremony. Chapters 20 through 23 lay kind of down the terms of how God, kind of the terms for the relationship, and then chapter 24 is like the wedding reception. So we'll look at that in just a second, but that's a framing. So a couple different things. All right, kids, here's some trivia. Write down this. So this one, this will be part of your trivia question. But the way from chapter 19 all the way to end, there's seven different ascents up the mountain. So Moses will ascend up the mountain seven different times to come into the presence of the Lord. That's very significant, very symbolic. All worship happens in this symbolic movement up the mountain. The mountain is where heaven and earth, they touch. So you go up into the mountain, into God's presence, so seven different times. That's also part of the macro framework of like the Gospel of Matthew. So Matthew has seven different ascents up seven different mountains. There's parallels. Another fascinating parallel, kids, write this one down. When we're looking at the construction for the tabernacle. So the way the literary movement of the book is from 20 to 24, we're going to get the book of the covenant, where God's going to give his, how he expects his family to behave in his house. So the theme is, all right, we're building a house together, and I'm going to dwell with you, and you're going to dwell with me. Now, here's kind of the house rules of how I expect my family to behave and act. And then in 25 through 31, he gives the building plans for how to build this house. And then there's the traumatic golden calf episode where they put the whole relationship in jeopardy. And then that covenant gets renewed and restored. And then from 33 on to 40, they actually build the house and God comes to dwell in the house they've made. And in 25 through 31, there's seven different thus saith the Lord's. And God says, this is how you build this house. And it echoes the 7 days of creation where God is going to enact the new creation happens because he's building a new house, a new temple, a new earth that he can dwell with his people. But here, let's look at 19, and they've returned to the mountain. And remember, the mountain is the place where Moses first encountered the living Lord while he was in the wilderness as an exile, a refugee, as he was cast out. Then he encounters the Lord in this burning bush. And then God says, this is a sign that you're going to know that I have spoken to you, that I'm going to bring you and all of Israel back to this mountain, and all of you are going to worship me here. And then here in chapter 19, we come and we see God has been true to his word. He's fulfilled his promise. And you can imagine in between Exodus 3 and Exodus 19, when they got there, I don't know how many times Moses probably doubted and wondered, there ain't no way I'm getting all these people back out there to worship at the mountain. But it's happened, and he's brought them back. Now, let's get a sense of kind of what's going on, because this will be important before we jump in. But look at chapter 19. It sets the timing. In the third month, from the very day the Israelites left the land of Egypt, they came to the Sinai wilderness. So they travel. They come to the mountain. In verse 3, Moses went up the mountain to God, and the Lord called to him. This is the first ascent. And then he says, this is what you must say to the house of Jacob and explain to the Israelites. You have seen, I notice you've seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I carried you on eagle's wings, and I have brought you to myself. So this is the framework of redemption. This is how it begins. Grace first. I redeemed you out of slavery. I carried you through the wilderness, and I have brought you to myself. Now you will listen carefully to me and keep my covenant. So he's established, this is not just an informal relationship. This is much more formal. It's more formal than just a friendship, but it's more loving than just like a contract you sign with like the bank. But that's what a covenant is. You're going to keep this covenant, and you will be my own possession. And out of all the peoples of the whole earth is mine, and you will be my kingdom of priests, and you will be my holy nation. So you got to feel the force of those personal pronouns. God's saying, you're mine. You are my treasured possession. And that's the dynamic of the covenantal relationship. You know, there's a huge difference between wife and your wife. There's a big difference between child and my child. And God is taking, he's claiming ownership. I'm going to be your God. You're going to be my people. And then notice Moses goes back and tells the people. And notice they hear that and they say, that's amazing. Look in verse 8. We will do all that the Lord has spoken. God says, okay, first thing you have to do is they're not ready to come into my presence. You have to go down in 3 days. You need to consecrate them. You have to wash them. They're dirty. They got to be cleaned. You got to get ready to come into the presence of the living Lord. But take this serious. Put boundaries, and if they cross the boundaries, they are going to die, because you cannot just come into the presence of the living God. You better take this serious. So they start getting ready, and then notice what happens starting in verse 17 of chapter 19. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was completely enveloped in smoke because the Lord came down in fire. And its smoke went up like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain shook violently. Remember, Moses encounters God and he's burning in a bush. Now the whole mountain is the bush and it's on fire. And the people come, and it says, and the sound of the ram's horn grew louder and louder. And Moses spoke, and God answered in the thunder. So God calls Moses up, and he goes up. But once Moses gets up there, God says, no, wait, they're coming too close. You better go get down, go back down and warn them. Don't come any closer. I'm serious. And as Moses comes down, that's when then God booms out, and that's when we have the Ten Commandments. That's how all of Israel heard God speaking out of the fire, and what they hear is him speaking to them, what we call is the Ten Commandments. Now, going over that, look in chapter 20, verse 18, and listen to how they respond to the voice of the living God. And all the people witnessed the thunder and the lightning and the sound of the ram's horn and the mountain surrounded by smoke. And the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. You speak to us and we will listen, they said to Moses, but don't let God speak to us or we will die. And Moses responded to the people, don't be afraid, for God has come to test you so that you will fear him and you will not sin. And all the people remained standing at a distance. And Moses approached to the total darkness where God was. So they recognize first, they're terrified. We can't come into his presence. So they ask, we need somebody who can go in between us and God, because if he talks to us, we're going to die. And what we're going to see this morning is there's a couple of things that if you're going to encounter the living Lord, there's certain things you have to have. You just need. And this is the first one they realize. We need a mediator. We need somebody who's going to go in between us and God. And Moses is that first one. So if you're going to have a life-changing encounter with God, the first thing you're going to need is you need to know you need a mediator. And one of the interesting things, these are all kind of put in echoes or foreshadows here in Exodus. Because what they begin to see is, all right, there's in essence kind of three different characters we're going to need who can mediate this relationship between us and God. All right, first, we need somebody like Moses who's going to talk to him. We need somebody who will go into his presence, hear what he has to say, and then come and tell us what he wants us to do. And then there's this enigmatic figure where he calls this the angel of the Lord. And he's going to go before you, and he's going to fight your battles. And he tells him in chapter 23 that when he goes before you, you better listen to everything he says, because he is not going to forgive you if you don't. But you have to obey him. So he's almost like this general of the Lord's army who you better obey. If you remember the scene where Joshua, before they enter into Canaan, encounters this angel of the Lord's army, and he falls down on his face, and Joshua says, are you for us or are you for our enemies? And he says, no, that's the wrong question. The question is not, am I on your side? The question is, are you on my side? I am doing this thing. So it's this strange character, this king who's going to fight their battles. But then he'll spend a lot of time saying you need this priestly figure. We need a whole group of priests who are going to sacrifice for us to help maintain the relationship that we have with God. And that's why we look back. We know part of the end of the story and the beauty when we sing, all I have is Christ. That's not like, man, I don't have anything. All I have are these crackers to eat. That's all I have is everything I need. Because in Christ, I have everything I need to come into and to live in the presence of the living Lord. He is this threefold mediator who does and gives and is all that I need. And so what do you need? I mean, you need a priest. And his job is to bring you into the presence of the Lord. His job is to keep the fires of the sacrifice burning so your love and your devotion doesn't fizzle out and flame out. You need somebody who can spiritually sanitize you because you need to be clean. One of the problems, there's two different problems of sin. One, it brings guilt. So sometimes we do what's wrong and it brings guilt and we need to confess that and have the relationship repaired. But then also there's an element that we'll see in the priestly service is that we're just dirty. Like we just get dirty being out in the world. And the stains of just death can touch us. That's one of the symbolism when it talks about like the women's menstrual cycle makes her unclean. It's not a moral uncleanness. It's your monthly reminder that you live under the shadow of death. And the very blood is leaving your body. And so it's just, we just become unclean. We get dirty, like priests or people living, working on farms who are constantly touching dead animals. They need to be made clean. So you have these two things that the priest needs to do. But it's not just a priest, you need a king. And the job of the king is to create the community that's going to live in the light of God's rule and reign and his justice. We have to obey. The king gives laws, and those laws are meant to be obeyed. So the priest's job is to kind of keep your devotion, your heart warm, and the flame of your relationship strong. The king's job is to tell you what you're supposed to do. This is how I'm supposed to live. You know, because sin also will stain a community. And it's so interesting when we get through, as we read through the covenant code and some of the laws that God gives to the Israelites, it's kind of strange. You're like, huh. That's an interesting thing. Like, why do we spend so much time on how do you mediate when two guys are fighting? Like, fist fighting. So it's talking about what do you do in this communal environment where conflict is going to come? How do you live in such a way where you have harmony in my household, is what he's saying. That's the king's job, to create the conditions where flourishing can happen. But then you also need the prophet. The prophet who goes up into the scary, dark presence of the Lord and then comes back to deliver his word and gives us God's will and his word and tells us the way God will save us from the way our mind can be distorted. That's what's so beautiful in the Heidelberg Catechism. You can see all of these things. These are the great gifts that Jesus is to us. So take some time this week and just look at that threefold ministry of Jesus and think, all right, of these three things, which do I need more of in my life? You need all of them, but in one sense, you can only work on one or two at a time, and you just need to press in. Which do you need more of? You know, the prophet who can teach you how you're supposed to think, the priest who can keep the devotion of your heart warm and glowing, or the king who's telling you how you're supposed to live. What are you supposed to do? You know, on the front of our bulletin, we talk about how we want this to be a place where you experience the transforming power of the gospel. And if you're going to experience it, you actually need all of these three things. And they're patterned after Jesus' ministry to us. You need sound doctrine. You need to be taught how you're supposed to think. And then you need renewal of the Holy Spirit. You need the fires of your devotion and love to be stoked and flamed. And then you need to know, how am I supposed to live? We live in this world. What does obedience, faithfulness look like here in this world? You know, you need all three. So think about your own life. Which one do you need more of now? One of my long-term goals for our discipleship hour is to always have different classes or different things that can help you in every category. Things that can help you think more biblically. Things that can help you love him more fully. And then things that can help your feet walk more faithfully in every category. Now, one of the things that's interesting when God gets into the kingly part is he starts to tell Israel, this is how I expect you to live. One of the things that shocked me this week is how much time he spends on this is how you order your time. Your time management is something very important to the Lord, and getting in regular routines of this is what you do every day, this is what you do weekly, and this is what you do on a yearly cycle, these time-based cycles. So which of those do you need? If you're going to encounter him, you need a mediator. But then there's something else you need that they see very quickly. Look in chapter 20. And so Moses, from chapter 20, verse 22, all the way to the end of 23, Moses goes into the presence of the Lord, and he starts giving him the book of the covenant, or this is the things I want you to do. This is how you act. And notice it begins, the very first thing, it begins with, you need to build an altar. Then the Lord told Moses, this is what you are to say to the Israelites. You have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. Such a fascinating way to phrase that. You saw what I said. You have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. Now do not make gods of gold for yourselves. Do not make gods of gold for yourselves. Make an earthen altar for me and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your fellowship offerings, your flocks and your herds, and I will come to you. Here's a promise. I'm going to come to you. But the place I come is I come to the altar. This is now the location of where our interaction is going to happen. You want a living relationship with me, you have to come to the altar. That's where I'm going to be found. So I will come to you, and there I'm going to bless you, and I will do this in every place where I cause my name to be remembered. This is what worship is. This is what prayer is. You call on the name of the Lord. You cry out to his name, and this is before, like, now you can call somebody, and they're hundreds of miles away. This is not this world. If you called out to someone, they had to be within earshot. And so what God is saying is you come to the altar, and I'm going to be close enough where I can hear you and you can hear me. But, he says, if you make a stone altar for me, do not build on it out of cut stones. If you use your chisel on it, you'll defile it. And do not go up on my altar on steps so that your nakedness is not exposed on it. These are the ordinances. Very strange. It's like you're going to have to build this altar. Now let's go to the end of this section. Flip over to look at chapter 24. Because we come to the very end, and this is the climax of this whole, really, the whole first part of the book of Exodus. And Moses has just delivered to the people. He's about to deliver them all the words of the Lord. It says, then he said to Moses, go up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of Israel's elders, and bow and worship at a distance. So everybody comes to the foot of the mountain. Now you guys are going to go in this next level up, you, the priest, and the 70 elders, and then you're going to bow in the Lord's presence. Moses alone will approach all the way up to the top of the mountain. So Moses the Lord, but the others are not to approach, and the people are not to go up with him. So Moses came and told the people all the commands of the Lord and all his ordinances, everything he's just told them from 20 to 23. And all the people responded with a single voice, we will do everything that the Lord has commanded. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early the next morning and he built, set up, the altar with 12 pillars, one for each of the tribes, 12 pillars, in essence, one large table where they each could come and have a seat at the table of the giant altar. Then he sent out the young Israelite men, the first who were going to act as the first priest, and they offered burnt offerings, and they offered with sacrifice of bulls and fellowship offerings. So those two offerings at the altar. And then Moses took half the blood, set it in a basin. The other half he put on the altar. Then he took the covenant scroll and read it aloud. And the people responded, we will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. And then the Lord took the blood and splattered it on the people and said, this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you concerning all these words. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, the 70 elders. And they saw the God of Israel. Beneath his feet was something like this pavement of this beautiful sterling, I was like crystal or this silver, but it's as clear as the heavens itself. So God pulls back the curtain just a touch, and they get this little bitty glimpse into the very front part of his throne room. It says, God did not harm the Israelite nobles, for they saw him, and they ate, and they drank. They had this fellowship meal. They're drawn into his presence. But it happens, notice the centrality of the altar. And on the altar, there's two different offerings. You have the burnt offering, and then you have the fellowship offering. Now, these categories are going to be really important because we'll go through, you go through Exodus, but really you go through the whole book of Leviticus because it's categorizing the different types of sacrifices. And sometimes it can be confusing, like, all right, this one is a dove, and this one's a turtle dove, and then this one is a bull that has to be a male, and this one can be male or female. This one you get to eat, this one you don't get to eat. Like, how does it all, like, fit together? Now, it's really helpful to think that in the sacrificial system, there's three big buckets that there's about a dozen different offerings, but they all can be dropped into one of the three buckets. One bucket are the sin offerings. So these are sin, guilt, atonement. This is to either purify you when you're unclean or to pay the price when you're guilty. So sin offerings. And then you have all of the burnt offerings, and those are the ones that represent dedication to the Lord. Those are the ones the offering was fully consumed. And then you have the fellowship offerings. Those were always the ultimate offerings, the final ones, the climax. These are the grain, the wine, and then the bull, the ox, the sheep. These are the ones you ate. So the point he gives us, all right, there's two that he highlights here. He highlights here at the altar of the burnt offerings and then the fellowship offerings. Now, these are really important because if you're going to have a living relationship with a living Lord, you need to work into your life burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. So what do they symbolize? It's really important as we look back because some of the sacrifice is just kind of weird language to us, but we need to remember, what are the sacrifices? The sacrifices are when the Lord takes a substitute that goes in our place to present to the Lord either something we need forgiveness and to be cleaned, or something we desire. We desire to be with you into your presence. And so that it represents, it's a symbolic representation of us. So think first, burnt offerings. Those were the offerings that were meant to be offered every single day, morning and evening, and those were the daily dedication offerings, the consecration offerings. Those would often be the smallest animal. They would be placed on the altar and they would be fully consumed. So the entire animal would be consumed, and then the ashes had to be tended all throughout the day. So you would have at least a morning offering when the sun rose, and then you have an evening offering when the sun set. And these are symbolic of being of dedicating your day to the Lord. So every day when the sun rose, we dedicate this, and it would ascend up to the Lord. And it's just a way of saying, thank you for this day. I commit myself fully to you this day. And part of the priest obligation was to make sure those fires from the burnt offering never went out. So you were always tending them. Those coals never went out. And it's just symbolic that my desire for you, my devotion, I'm dedicating all of my life to you. Here it is. I give it to you. And so when you think about like the burnt offerings, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard that farmer joke about, you know, the chickens are involved in breakfast, but the pig is committed to breakfast. And so the burnt offerings, they're committed to your devotion to the Lord. And so what those are, we're a symbolic way of saying we're dedicated to you. And as long as the tabernacle was there, they would see that smoke rising every moment. And it was a pictorial reminder to the Israelites that all we are and do is meant to be a dedication to you. Take it. It's yours. We want to serve and love you with this day. And one of the things the Lord does, once he tells them in Deuteronomy, once you go out into the land, and now you're not geographically as close to the tabernacle or eventually the temple and you don't see it, what you need to do is you need to recite the Shema. That became the dedication offering that the Israelites would say every morning when they rose. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. This is my morning dedication where I'm reminding myself of who I am. I am yours. And today I want to love you with all my heart, mind, and soul, and strength. And then you come to the end of the day. And you say, oh, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. I'm reminded who I am. Thank you for this gift of today. And now I commit my night to you. And then the Psalms, the first, when you look at Psalm 13 through Psalm 14, those are different cycles of songs that are meant to be morning prayers and evening prayers, of a morning dedication and an evening dedication. And then in the New Testament, that gets transformed. That's what Paul's talking about in Romans 12 when he says that when you, by view of the mercies of the living God, you offer yourself as a living sacrifice where you dedicate your life to him. The very first discipleship manual that we have, the Didache, encourages new Christians to say the Lord's Prayer three times a day. When you first rise, this is your morning sacrifice of prayer where you dedicate yourself to the Lord. You say it at lunchtime to kind of, stir the coals of your heart. And then you say it when the sun goes down to remind yourself and give thanks for who he is and what he's given. So if you're going to encounter the Lord, you need some type of altar where you're giving up these burnt offerings, prayers of praise where you're dedicating my life, my day to you. They don't have to be long or they don't have to be elaborate, but a pause and committing that to him. And then the second offering is on the offering of the fellowship offering, and that's the feast. That's where you come and you eat and you celebrate and the feast. And one of the things we're going to key in all throughout the Old Testament, he wants to remind them, this is symbolic of what you live on. Don't forget, man does not live on bread alone, but you live on the word. And so the feast is meant to be symbolic of every day coming into his presence and feeding on his word. It's the bread of life that you eat from. And both of these two offerings are symbolic of what you need if you're going to enter into the presence of the living Lord. You have to have these routines and these resources to have these two offerings. And one of the things we want to start helping you is giving you resources and things to help you have those daily kind of burnt offerings. That's part of what our kids' bulletin we want to shift so it can have more resources to help kids develop that rhythm and that routine and some different resources in our bulletin to help you. Now, what I love here is it says this thing, it can be made out of earth. It doesn't have, don't make it out of gold and silver. Like, the tabernacle is going to be elaborate. The temple is going to be one of the great wonders of the world. But the altar you make at home does not have to be elaborate or exotic. In fact, they're going to break this command in chapter 32 when they make the golden calf and build its own altar. He says it can be very simple, but it's a place that you make where you dedicate to the Lord and reminds you of whose you are. And you think about what you might need to create a place and a space for that burnt offering. Thinking about John Wesley, John and Charles Wesley, their mother. You might think, man, I've got no time in my life to be making burnt offerings every morning to dedicate time to the Lord. John and Charles Wesley, their mother, I think they either had 12 or 15 kids. We need another fact checker to go look. It's somewhere in that neighborhood, 12 or 15. But one of the things she would do is she would take a chair and she would set it on the dining room table. And then she would sit in the chair. Now, this is Victorian England where you had 7-8 layers of dresses deep. And she would take the outer layer of her dress and she would take it like a tent and she'd cover up her head. And the kids knew, unless you were on fire or had lost a limb, do not bother mother. Because when she's on the table with her dress over her head, she is praying to God. And do not disrupt her. So I don't know what lengths you might have to go to create your altar. But it's worth it. And one of the amazing things, you look throughout church history, the way God has blessed his people when they pause and that they create dedicated times to come to him. I was thinking about, a couple weeks ago, I was thrilled as I was going through iTunes Music, and there was this band that came from my hometown that used to play at our youth group. Now, admittedly, they were not great. But they had this one song that was a song of like dedication that when I was in high school, it was really meaningful to me because I had this kind of crossroad in my life and they kind of cry out, they're telling the Lord, all I have, all I am, I'm gonna give it to you. And I pulled it up and the family was in the car and I was listening to it and just, you know, being so moved by the music. And now I am not the one with any musical skill or expertise in my house, so I have to defer to the opinions of those around me. And about 3/4 way through the song, Cynthia very politely put her hand on my leg and says, honey, I'm sorry. I just can't take the song anymore. I was like, what do you mean you can't take it? She's like, I'm sorry, he's just not a good singer. And I was morally offended because like, no, this is John. Like, we went to high school. He's amazing. Are you, like, he's really not good? And she's like, no, I'm sorry, he's not good. And my oldest daughter chimes up from the back of the car with her 2 cents. And she said, yeah, Dad, he's terrible. He sounds like a constipated elephant. And I said, as somebody who has dedicated his life to metaphors and words right now, I am so proud of you. Because that is such a beautiful, I mean, that metaphor is amazing. But you have just ruined that song, and now I will never again be able to listen to that song without thinking of the mental image of a constipated elephant, so thank you very much. Like, a part of my childhood has just died. So all that to say, it does not have to be an exceptionally well-crafted song where you're saying, I'm committing myself, I'm giving it to you. The skill, the musical skill doesn't have to be top-notch. But the point is the heart of the matter this time where we dedicate, I give this to the Lord. I've got a whole handful of case studies from church history where you can see what happens in God's people when a group of them come together and they make an altar. But we'll save that for next week. And what I want to just close with, notice, did you hear? You know, it kind of sets up this dynamic of the covenant that the Lord is going to give them this word, and the people, they're so eager, they want to love him, they want to obey. And do you hear the eagerness? Yes, we will do everything that you command. I mean, the spirit is willing. They want to obey. We will do it all. But then if you know the story, it's not even 40 days later for they have failed that commitment. And this kind of brings us into the tension of the Old Testament. Like, God at the same time is a lawgiver who has to be obeyed, but he's also a loving father or loving husband who wants to love his people. How can you have both of these things together? It's a great mystery. How can the love of God and the law of God coexist? Is there anyone who can truly fulfill and obey the covenant to bring those two things together? And every week when we come to the Lord's table, we celebrate the new covenant meal that points us to the one who was able to ultimately unite those things. It points us to the one who was able to fully obey and earn all the blessings of the covenant and then bear the penalty and pay the price for all of the failures of the covenant. And so on the cross, he received all the curses that covenant disobedience brings, and then he gives in his grace all of the blessings to those who trust him and turn. It's his blood that covers the people, and transformation happens when you look and you see and you look to the ultimate covenant keeper. So as we close and we come to the table here at Trinity each week, we come to the Lord's table. It's our reminder of the gift we have in Christ. That's the new covenant, the way that has been made so we can come into the presence of the Lord. And it's not flashy, it's not elaborate, but it points us to our Savior. So we'll have four different stations, a gluten-free one in the back, and then once our servers are in place, you come.